day, and welcome to the Cigna Drug and Alcohol Education Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference to Ann Sweeney-Levant. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Rochelle. My name is Ann Sweeney-Levant, and I am the lead clinician for outpatient team in Cigna. Due to the format of this call, you'll not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, we'll be transmitted to a brief 5-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. And then after the survey, there'll be a question and answer time about today's seminar. If there is information about the seminar today on our website, cignabehavioral.com, if you go onto the website, click on the left-hand side where it says Visit Our Education and Resource page, and then click on Drug and Alcohol Awareness, then Drug and Alcohol Awareness, a Cigna Education Series. And if you scroll down, you'll see today's date and find information about our presenters today. Please note that not all policies cover today's topic. For more specific information on if your policy covers today's topic, please contact the outpatient team by calling a number on the back of your insurance card. And today I have the pleasure of introducing Sarah Luz Fernandez. Sarah is the Assistant Program Director at Dynamic Youth Community, Inc., an adolescent outpatient program located in Brooklyn, New York. And most recently, she was part of a presentation panel for a discussion on a therapeutic community model of treatment at the 13th Annual ASAP Conference. And joining Sarah today is Marisa Manlove. Marisa is a co-chair of the Parent Advisory Board of the Partnership at DrugFree.org and founding board chair of the 24 Group, a local parent support and education group in Indianapolis, Indiana. So with that, I will pass the call on today to Sarah and Marisa.
Thanks, Ann. Well, hello, podcast listeners. Good afternoon. Today I'm going to talk about the need for the parent to get help when you have a child involved with drugs or alcohol. I'll be providing information from the professional's perspective, and joining me will be Marisa Manlove, who will be sharing her experience from the viewpoint as a parent. We're going to give an overview of the family system and its effects on addiction. Then we're going to go through the stages from active addiction to late-stage recovery and aftercare treatment. I know you might be distracted by your computer or your phone during this podcast. I know it's hard to just listen in. But please jot down any questions you have because we might miss some important points that you can add or you can ask about. Marisa, can you start us off by sharing how you became an advocate for families with addiction?
Sure. Thanks so much, Sarah, and thank you for the opportunity to just share a little bit about what my journey has been. I'll start out by saying that I'm the mother of two sons, Josh and David. I have a beautiful and wonderful daughter-in-law, Angie. I've been married to my husband, Kim, for almost 33 years, and really I just consider our family to be a fairly typical suburban household living in Indianapolis, Indiana. And so, as I said, my journey with addiction began over 12 years ago when an incident occurred that forced Kim and I to realize that our then 15-year-old son, David, was using alcohol and smoking pot at a level way beyond what we thought was just teenage experimenting. We got David into an assessment at a nearby treatment center. We were fortunate that we had one very close by that provided services to adolescents, and we were shocked at the level of use that he admitted to. Although they recommended he begin their intensive outpatient program, we actually initially thought we could just handle the problem ourselves, you know, now that we knew it was a problem, by just closer monitoring of his activities and some home drug screening. But that, of course, wasn't enough. So 6 months later, we went back to the treatment center. David went through 8 weeks of their IOP, followed by then once a week aftercare meetings. He was going to 12-step meetings, and he also was getting weekly counseling visits with a specialist in adolescent addiction. So although David seemed to be doing pretty well, I think we really, all of us, my husband and I, my other son and David as well, really misunderstood the power of this disease. We didn't know it at the time, but while he was still in treatment, David had learned that he could get high but still pass his drug screens by huffing computer duster. So one sunny day in early June in 2000, this was by then 2001, David went to a friend's house to go swimming, and I got the call that's a parent's worst nightmare. David was huffing while he was underwater in the shallow end of the pool. The action of the inhalant put his heart in cardiac arrest, and he died of what's called sudden sniffing death syndrome. Well, of course, his death just shattered our lives, but slowly, slowly, we began to put the pieces back and adapt to what was, you know, we sort of called the new normal. And then 2 years later, my world got totally turned upside down again when my husband revealed that he thought he, too, had a problem, that he was probably an alcoholic, and he needed to get treatment himself. That's when I finally realized that if I was going to survive, I needed to get help for myself.
Oh. Thanks so much, Maurice. This is such a candid sharing. I really appreciate, you know, you being on here and providing such an important perspective that parents are going to be able to relate to as they listen in. As we can hear, addiction and recovery is a roller coaster of emotions and experiences, and there is no place more evident than this in the journey that families experience with addiction. While the family cannot take full responsibility for causing this disorder, they do suffer from the disruptive impact. Family life orients itself around the illness, sometimes for years. There is no specific diagnosis for a parent of a substance abuser, but that doesn't mean that there aren't many feelings that develop and need to be properly and professionally addressed for the family to recovery. There are times that clinical depression and anxiety can be present and need medical intervention. A parent can even be triggered by their own past of growing up in an addicted family. It can bring to the surface old issues that may or may not have been resolved. This point we will bring up a few times. Research has proven that family involvement in treatment brings about greater chances for recovery. So for those of us thinking, it's their problem, it's not mine, she's the one who's using, I'm not doing anything wrong, the user is the sick one, they need help, it's not me, I'm fine, this presentation is especially for you. We might talk about some things here that hit home, strike a chord, or even offend. I want to be clear that while we're going to talk about the need for the family member to work on themselves and be part of the recovery process, that does not mean that we think family members are inherently bad. It's just that sometimes we love our kids to death. We're going to talk about how the addiction affects the family. We see the family as a system. Family systems model tells us that addiction affects each member of the family. Intervention to any part of the system affects the whole system. Oftentimes the example is given of a baby's mobile, that when, you know, the baby or someone touches one part of the mobile, all the parts of it start moving. That this behavior of individual members is interrelated to the process of circular causality. So if one member of the family member changes, the other's members will change as a consequence, which then in turn causes subsequent changes in the member who first changed. So, for example, family members of people using may develop codependence, which causes them to enable the child's continued use. It's really impossible to know if enabling or substance abuse came first, but what we do know that each affects each other and both need to change to create a new level of normal or equilibrium in the family. So now we're going to start going through the stages of addiction and recovery. The first one we're going to talk about here is when a child is actively using substances. So some feelings a parent might go through and experience are fear, shame, chaos, helplessness, panic, anger, and anger at many things. Anger at the child directly if they were stealing from them, or embarrassment, or anger if they were stealing from friends or relatives. Many times there's missing very special heirlooms in the family. The parent might also be very tired or just drained from going from one treatment center to the next, searching for the right one or the one that might finally stop their child from continuing using and getting worse. Sometimes we believe that the child experimenting is a normal part of the process of growing up. This can come from our own experience of experimenting with substance. This can cause guilty feelings, which then drives a lack of confrontation. During active use, the user manipulates caregivers into believing the truth is not really the truth. They expertly get us to doubt ourselves. This erodes our natural parental instincts. This is another major reason to get help for yourselves, because we must undo this doubt and gain back the trust in your instincts to parent. It's very important to be confident and confront directly when you see something off or questionable, and sit down and talk with the family. Parents can avoid bad feelings in the same way that the adolescent user does, and it's important to face them in the same way the child will need to do when they enter recovery. Marissa, what do you think about this, and how did you feel when your child was actively using?
Well, you know, I think when David's use was at its highest point, when his disease was really building, I was actually pretty clueless. David was just 13 when we found out about an incident with alcohol. And although I remember feeling concerned, it was also an, okay, this is a little wake-up call. We don't need to panic. We just need to remind David that, okay, this isn't okay with us. It's dangerous. Don't ever do it again. As I recall, we grounded him for a week, which, of course, he thought was a, you know, way too serious of a consequence. And I thought, all right, that's sending him the sufficient message that, you know, stop doing this. So I think at that point I wasn't feeling too overly concerned. There were two or three more incidents with pot and alcohol, at least that we knew about, when Dave was in eighth and ninth grades. But I still didn't think that that meant that it was a problem. Because at that point, he was an athlete, a very successful athlete. He'd been playing baseball since he was five, and he was on his a catcher on his freshman baseball team. He was doing well in school. In hindsight, I know now that his grades in as a freshman were definitely not as good as middle school, but he had lots of friends. He was charming. He was, you know, usually pleasant to be around. And it's a little bit of what you were saying, Sarah. I think my parental instincts were being fooled by some of the things that I was seeing and my stereotype of what I thought, well, I would know what it would look like if he was having a problem. Then the summer after freshman year, that's when his use really just like suddenly seemed to shoot up to an alarming degree. And that's when then I moved into that fear and panic mode. But even then, I think my parental denial was still in full force. I mentioned we got him into an assessment the first time. And you know, it was, well, now that we know there's a problem, I'm a super mom. I'm capable. I know how to handle this. We always had a good relationship with both our boys. Communication wasn't a problem, or we didn't think it was. So I really still thought everything will be fine. My gut was telling me that things were more serious, but I still desperately wanted to believe David's half-truths and those reasonable-sounding excuses, because I think at that point I couldn't or maybe just didn't want to face the truth about what was really happening.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of why it's so hard for the whole family to face the addiction. So even though we know that since the early 70s, treating adolescents has proven effective, most adolescents don't voluntarily enter treatment. They're either court or what we lightly call mom-dated to stop denying the problem. Family members are sometimes the first to begin treatment and seek out professional help, either at this stage or through a counselor or a 12-step support group. Parents may have a stronger desire to move towards overall improved family functioning, thus compelling and even providing leverage for the person to seek or remain in treatment through periods of ambivalence about achieving sobriety. It's important to mention here and not forget the siblings in the family. They are also affected. Sometimes they feel their needs and concerns are ignored or minimized while the parent is, you know, forced to react to the constant crisis of the child who's using substances. Neglected siblings may sometimes look for ways to get attention negatively or develop ways to look after themselves in ways that are not age-appropriate or they shouldn't have to. The siblings can also be instrumental in breaking the denial in the parents because they tend to be closer to the action. They know their friends. They can see what's going on. So a lot of times they're the ones that are, you know, telling the parents that there's a problem here. The concept of putting your oxygen mask on first, it's a very good analogy for the need for the parent to take care of themselves to be able to help their children. But as parents, we often feel very guilty about taking time out for ourselves. In many families where a child is using, at least one of the parents are also abusing substances. And if the response to the child's use is coming from the impaired parent, hypocrisy will be obvious and the result is likely to be negative. In some cases, the impaired parent might even form an alliance with the adolescent using substances to keep secrets from the parent who doesn't use. The other parent is also viewed as accepting of the parent's behavior and can be used as leverage for the adolescent to continue using. Clarifying boundaries between dysfunctional members, including encouraging the child to detach from active users, can alleviate stress and create the emotional space necessary to focus on sobriety. The next stage we're going to talk about is when the person begins to enter the treatment program. Feelings that parents might go through are numbness, misplaced anger, either at the treatment provider themselves, an ex-spouse, the child's school, the peers or friends of the child. You know, it's always those bad friends. It's not our kids that are using. They also might feel anxiety, shock, confusion. Things are happening so fast, there's no time to really process or understand what's happening. This really is one of the most challenging times because you're entering into a new system and it's a lot of things are going on at once. It's important to note that this is a process, to try to just accept that the resistance and noncompliance at this point are normal. Sometimes parents push and are begging and pleading, do this for me, do this because we love you. This tactic might initially work. It usually is not enough for the person to remain in treatment and do the work that's necessary to really achieve the change, to remain abstinent. It usually does take a few sessions to get a child involved in the program. Marisa, what were you feeling when your child was at the first in the intake process and just beginning?
Well, at that first intake, I definitely was scared and apprehensive. I was relieved that we were taking that first step to getting help for David. I don't think at that point I was seeing it so much as help for me, but help for David. I mentioned before that I was shocked at the level of his use, as well as I think a little shocked at the intensity of what sounded to me like a very intensive program, the intensive outpatient program. And I don't know if that's what fed into my thinking that we could still handle things ourselves. It was actually our older son, Josh, who was instrumental in helping us to understand that things weren't going as well as we thought they were, I was actually making excuses to Josh for David's behaviors, and Josh was saying, no, you're not getting it. Some of David's friends also, by then Josh was a freshman in college, but Josh was getting emails from some of David's friends saying, you know, your brother's pretty messed up. So he's the one that forced us to take a look at this more seriously, and a big part of why we got the second assessment. And then when the reality and the seriousness of David's situation finally started to sink in, that's when I kicked into the numb, helpless, confused, how in the heck did it get to this point? And I had no idea stage.
Yeah, absolutely. You're not alone. Many families are shocked and don't understand the length, the intensity of treatment that's recommended. Parents might sometimes want to believe that it's just experimental. Denial has them not wanting to know how serious the use has become. There is a need at this point to be, you know, help parents become aware of how serious the addiction is and for the ability to accept the treatment. Once a parent we find finds out and hears the reality, then they're usually open to the treatment recommendation. But some parents say, like you did before, I'll keep them home, I'll watch out for this, I'll do this. Like, now that I know, like, I'll be able to do this. Like, thanks for telling me. But sometimes that's like another kind of denial to see how serious it is. And what our intake department does, as I'm sure others do, is have the child directly tell the parents what they are using, and that the honesty of that usually does break the denial down. The change in the family member not using throws the family into a new crisis of having to adapt and find new ways to cope with family problems that have been masked by the focus on the user. It is extremely important to provide orientation, basic education, and guidelines at this point, to help the family know what to expect and how to proceed. Family members need to know the rules and be encouraged from the beginning to participate actively and support the treatment process. You know, the thought of how come I couldn't do it is very common at this stage, and initial groups help break that isolation and the self-blame that parents go through. The next stage that we're going to talk about is what we're calling the middle time in treatment. This is a time that you can really focus in on yourself as a parent or caregiver. The child is now a little stable in treatment and is generally safe from using. Some feelings that might begin to surface are anger, guilt, defensiveness. You know, and I want to make a note here. We certainly are in a time of competitive parenting, and it makes it even more difficult to identify what you know, maybe you've done something wrong. Maybe there's something for yourself to look at. Maybe there's something that contributed to the addiction. Which, you know, by the way, there are no perfect parents out here. There aren't. I learned that early on working in this. It might even surprise you some of the things that stick with our kids and that affect our kids. some things maybe that you won't remember yourself, but it affected them, and it's important for them to talk about that and feel that and say that. So either way, it is important for you to try to identify what you can in your own self so that, you know, when you have a family session or you have a family discussion, you're more prepared for some of the negative feelings that your child has been expressing that really need to be brought to light and so that you can heal together. Common challenge that needs to be identified here so you can help the family prepare how to cope with this stage. For example, if the child wants to leave the program, different options need to be given and discussed so that we don't enable that behavior. Problem-solving assistance should be offered. Flexibility is needed in tailoring interventions and responding to different family members' needs as they arise. Multifamily groups, we love, and family individual sessions as well, they're necessary for changing the negative communication patterns in the family and to change the maladaptive way the family adjusted to the substance abuser. For example, the need to go over some family rules that aren't so healthy, exposing secrets and taboo subjects to start broaching them and bringing them to light. Marissa, can you share a little bit more about how you felt when your child was now, like, safely in the treatment program?
Sure. I can tell you the first night of David's IOP was a multifamily group, and I know both Kim and I were like deer in headlights. It felt, you know, surreal. But I was also, you know, relieved because, again, it felt like, all right, now we've got some professionals who are helping us. And, you know, really, I think it was partly that they're going to know what to do to help fix David so that we could go back to how life had been before. I don't know that I ever felt actually anger, but I'm sure that I know that there was some guilt and defensiveness of, you know, how, again, how did we let it get to this level? How did I not see it? And not really being too comfortable with talking with other people, our closest friends, family, about what was really happening. So I was really grateful for the education that we were getting in that program, because the treatment center where we were very much involved family as much as they wanted to. So we got a lot of good education about the disease, but also then the support that we got from the other parents who were also going through IOP. It was just wonderful to know that we weren't the only ones going through this, that we had other people that we could talk to. So as the weeks went on and we learned more about the disease, I started feeling then cautiously optimistic about what was coming next. Again, I think I was still minimizing David's problems. You know, we compare our story to some of the other stories that we were hearing in group, because David had willingly, or, you know, relatively anyway, entered treatment. He wasn't in any legal trouble. This is the first time we were ever going through this. We still had a close and loving relationship. You know, things weren't awful at home. So it was like maybe the third week in IOP during multifamily group, David introduced himself for the first time after he said his name, that he was an addict. And I thought, what did he just say? It's like it hit me like a ton of bricks, even though we'd been there for, you know, by then 3 weeks or so. I guess it was maybe the beginning of my finally looking more closely at what I had been doing to maybe unintentionally enable David's disease.
It's so important when we get these realizations for ourselves, and those light bulbs start going off. And it does, like you said, often happen in group, just hearing from other people or hearing from your child itself, because sometimes we just want to believe what we want to believe so that we feel more comfortable. So thank you. The last stage of that we're going to talk about here is late treatment, aftercare, and even after treatment. And different feelings that we go through now that we see are fear. Fear of waiting for the other shoe to drop. Some parents get even, you know, stay or remain overly worried. They never get comfortable. They're still checking pupils every time the child comes in the door. Or even on the other extreme, we see parents that can get too comfortable at this stage. Like, it's over. This was just a bad time. It's cured. You know, thank you. We'll be on our way, type of attitude. Marisa, again, can you share how did you feel when your child began the aftercare part and was almost finished?
Well, a lot of the feelings that you mentioned, that you talked about. After IOP was over, again, I was thinking, okay, David gets it. He's going to his 12-step meetings. He's going to follow what he learned in treatment. Kim and I better understand now about addiction, so we're making the adjustments at home about how to, you know, set better consequences or have better conversations about what was going on. You know, he's not going to pull things over on us now. But also a big part was, you know, phew, life can finally get back to normal. So I couldn't understand why, after all that we'd gone through in this 8 weeks of IOP, and then when he starts into aftercare, then we start getting calls that David was called into in-school suspension because he was skipping classes. His grades were totally tanking. He got arrested after he and a friend got caught not breaking into cars, but apparently finding cars that were unlocked and then helping themselves to whatever they found. He had snuck out that night after we went to bed, took my car, and we get the call Sunday morning, and it's him on the phone, and he says, you know, Mom, you know, you always tell me I have to learn things the hard way. Well, I'm in jail. And so, you know, I was so totally confused. I was angry then, and I was deathly afraid because, you know, he was still theoretically passing his drug screens, and I was so focused that, oh, my gosh, this means he's going to relapse and he's going to start smoking pot again. You know, I wasn't seeing, well, hello, he already had relapsed, even if he wasn't actually using some of the substances I was worried about. His, you know, his mind has relapsed. He had already moved into that mode. So instead of life getting back to normal, then it, you know, it got more intense, and I definitely got more tense, more anxious, worried, scared about the consequences of David's legal troubles. You know, I still wanted to believe, though, that David wanted a recovery, that he understood the consequences of his actions. So I still had hope, and I still had that feeling that I could manage the situation, you know, and manage his recovery for him.
Again, I think that's very common. Many family members and treatment professionals even can share the unrealistic beliefs that, you know, treatment accomplished this in the treatment center and normal life can then resume. And what really happens is what you described, a honeymoon period, it's exciting, you finished, you're good, things are calm. And then tensions start to mount, life starts happening, and problems can resurface. And sometimes at that point, relapse can happen. And let me just touch on quickly here about how, you know, sometimes, you know, I know drug screens are sold now and you can get them pretty much anywhere. I think we depend too much on them, and we just completely count on the drug screen. Well, it's negative, it's negative. And like we talked about before, discounting your own parent instincts and seeing that there's something wrong here, like what's happening in front of your face. And again, I know we want to believe that the person is doing well, but we can't ignore what we're seeing, and it's important to face that and not count on just the drug screen to tell you that, you know, everything's fine here. Really, the family needs to develop new communication skills, reorganize the family patterns in order to reduce stress and support the optimal functioning of this individual. Families need long-term support and assistance to bring long-term recovery to the family. Sustained recovery requires major readjustments in all family members and a reorganization of the family unit. Sometimes there's a lack of motivation for family to get help, like we talked about before. She's the one with the problem or he's the one with the problem. Belief. Truth is that family systems have the potential to influence the outcome of treatment for the individual, and we know that providing services to the whole family improves treatment effectiveness. Just to summarize some of the goals of family therapy that I think we've touched on throughout this, but just to, you know, just give you a perspective of what family work wants to accomplish. The first thing is stopping the use in the person that's actively using, stopping at this generation, what we sometimes call stopping the cycle. Two, preventing siblings from using. Three, providing a neutral forum in which family members meet to solve problems. Four, ensuring each family member has a voice in the family.
Why? Providing a safe environment in which pent-up feelings of anger, fear, or concern can be expressed, identified, and validated. Often family members are surprised to learn that others share their feelings and new lines of communication open up. 6, the therapist looks for unhealthy relational structure, sometimes parent and child role reversals. They look at faulty patterns of communication. Therapy works to shift power to the parent figures and improves communication. Finally, 7, the ultimate goal is for the child that was using to return to a house that has become stable, functional environment in which abstinence can be sustained and growth for the whole family happens. And I just want to say it's more important than just coming and showing up. The child can feel and will know if the parent isn't really doing the work necessary on themselves and isn't really committed to the recovery of the family. For example, expressing that you don't agree with something that's going on in the program. It undermines the work that the therapist is doing, and it can make the child feel that they're doing something wrong by staying on track with the program. They can even feel that they're betraying their own family by remaining abstinent. Parent involvement makes the young adult feel supported and keeps them on track for themselves in fighting an addiction that tells them that they do not have an addiction. And the last thing they need is for their own parent to be that voice as well. Marisa, can you share how you came about getting help for yourself and recovering with your family and what you found was helpful for you in the process?
Well, one of the, I think, most helpful things about David being in treatment was that family education series that my husband and I went through as part of the program. Even though I never dreamed it would ever happen, could happen in our family, I think in my head I did understand that addiction is a disease that can result in death. When David died, my husband was out of town, and I had called the treatment center to see if someone there could come join us at the emergency room, because I felt like I needed somebody with me, in addition to my older son, who would understand what we were going through. And I don't really remember this, but David's aftercare counselor was there, and apparently, I don't remember saying this, but his aftercare counselor told me that I said to him, David died of his addiction. I didn't say, you know, David died from an accidental drowning or he died because he was, you know, using this specific substance, but of his addiction. So I think in my head I understood that. My heart wasn't there yet, obviously. The sharing and the support we got from the other parents in our multifamily group meetings, that was extremely helpful. I talked about that before. We learned from each other. We laughed together. We cried together. I think we got hope from each other, even though they certainly recommended Al-Anon at that point was recommended, but you know, I still thought I was handling things, so I didn't think I needed that part. But we did go to some of the open meetings, 12-step meetings with David, and that was helpful in me learning more about the disease and again, I'm beginning to understand a little bit more about what David was going through. The individual therapy, I mentioned he was also going to an additional counselor for individual therapy, and that did include some time with us as parents as well, and so that was really helpful. I remember at one point his therapist saying, Marisa, yes, you want to show David unconditional love, but what you can do is you can make the actual demonstration of that conditional on some things. You can say, no, you know, this, you know, there are certain things that that I need to be seeing, because I was, you know, again, so much about, well, I want to be sure that he's feeling supported in all of this. A few months after David's death, the treatment center asked us actually to help start a parent support group for parents of adolescents going through treatment as sort of a parent aftercare, because we definitely identified that that was something that was missing, that part that comes after the intensive acute care. And my husband and I also began sharing our family story in presentations to youth and family groups as a way to, you know, maybe help others learn from our situation, but also honoring David's struggle, giving him a voice, and, you know, sort of we felt like it was a way for him to make a difference. So those things really helped me to begin to heal after his death, or at least move through the grief, to begin to understand that we did all that we knew to do at the time, and to begin to understand the power of the disease. Because we had such a rapid, you know, 11 months after okay, this is a problem, he's gone. So we went through things, you know, in a very compressed way in some ways. So then with that, and we were starting to come back to recovery, when my husband then entered treatment 2 years later, again, me not putting the words to, I probably was seeing some things, but he had a reason to drink, and I wasn't questioning, again, that part of it, because what he was doing didn't look like what I thought alcoholism would look like. And that's finally, I felt like I'd been punched in the stomach after all that we'd gone through. And that's when I finally had to acknowledge that my life was unmanageable. That's when I started attending Al-Anon, really began understanding just how sick I had become as a result of this disease and learning what I could do to get healthy myself. So almost 9 years later, I still attend 2 Al-Anon meetings a week. I still help to co-facilitate that weekly parent support group with my husband. They mentioned before, Kim and I are co-chairs of the parent advisory board for the partnership, and that support has been tremendous, not only in being able to help develop some resources that we hope can help other families, but just connecting again with a wonderful group of families who we have such a shared passion for what we're doing and shared understanding. You know, I know treatment works because I see miracles happen all the time, but I've learned what you said at the beginning, Sarah, that the best thing that I can do for the people I love who have this disease is to put my oxygen mask on first. So the helpline that the partnership has, and I know we're going to talk about resources later, but 1-885-DRUG-FREE, it's a wonderful helpline that you can talk to a professional with who's an expert in adolescent addiction about, you know, whatever questions you have. But you can also, if you want to, get connected to another parent who's gone through some of this. So all of that is, I know, is so much help. My life hasn't exactly quite turned out the way I thought it would. Of course, I'd do anything to have David back, but through my own recovery in many ways, my life is actually richer and more fulfilling than I ever thought would be possible.
Oh, thank you. I just want to ask another question, just to really try to give any parents and professionals that are listening. When you talk about being, you know, that you realized that you were sick yourself, and what you needed to do to get healthy. Can you share any of those realizations that you came to with anyone that's listening?
Sure. You know, I definitely came to understand the things that I was doing that were unintentionally, with David, unintentionally enabling his disease to get stronger. You know, I was doing all of those things out of love. We do things as parents because we want to help our kids. We want to protect them. We don't want to see them suffer the consequences of their dumb actions. But I, you know, I really have come to understand that I was actually unintentionally enabling his disease to get stronger, but I've also then through recovery learned to accept that that's what I, all that I knew to do at the time, to forgive myself for that piece, but to learn from it, to move forward, to share, you know, what I've learned, with others. I've learned about just, you know, that whole thing about, oh, I can manage everything, I can control everything, the illusion of control versus what do I really have control over. And I've learned what I really only have control over is myself, my own actions, me doing the next right thing, not placing inappropriate expectations on a situation and then have it not turn out the way I wanted to do, and so then try to manipulate or do things so that it gets to what I wanted, and not realizing that in some ways that's interfering with the real consequences of someone's behavior coming out. And so I just, those are some of the things that I've learned, and hope. I've learned that there's always hope. And to never give up on the possibility of recovery.
No, you're right. I mean, treatment really does work. I think a lot of times the negative is highlighted, you know, in media and other places. It's always very, you know,
traumatic, obviously, when we heard the loss of this, and that is very real, as you've shared yourself. But we don't hear a lot of that there is recovery, that it does work. When you do the right thing and you stick things out, that there's plenty and millions of people living amongst us that are recovering every day. Thanks for reminding us of that. And I just really want to thank you, Marisa, for just your honesty is so appreciated here. Thanks for talking with me and enlightening me and everyone else that's listening. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks. Before we leave, we want to leave you with a few places that you can go to get help for yourself and your family. Number one, like Marisa already mentioned, but it's an excellent resource, the partnership at drugfree.org. Again, their helpline is 1-855-DRUG-FREE. They're available Monday through Friday from 10 to 6. And like Marisa was saying, you could speak to a parent specialist there, someone who really would understand like what a parent is going through. You don't always get that in other places that you would call and reach out. It's usually for the person who's an addict, so they really specialize in that. Two, Al-Anon and Family Anonymous that Marisa shared has been very helpful. 12-step and the open 12-step groups. I didn't think of that, but you know, you shared that absolutely. The open regular AA or NA meetings that you can go to that anyone's welcome to come and just you know listen and get support from. Another thing that you can do is, you know, any community family support groups that you find in your community and sometimes religious centers, sometimes they're just offering a family support. You can call any family treatment programs, some that we happen to be familiar with, or the one that I work in is Dynamic Youth Community located in New York, here in New York City. Our phone number is 718-376-7923. You can call here for help or referral. I happen to know the Karen Foundation in Pennsylvania has an excellent codependency piece. There's a program called Family Drug Treatment in Florida that has a family-specific piece. The place that, Marisa, your family was involved with Fairbanks Treatment Center, I think they've been very helpful there in Indianapolis. And there's many, many others. I think what we can say is just call the local provider in your area. Ask them if they do provide family treatment programming. Do they have any family sessions? Do they have any family support groups that can be helpful to you? And, you know, of course, you can reach out to any social worker or even a marriage and family counselor specialist. They can be useful from pre-intervention, you know, meeting with you, meeting with your family, to post-treatment support and work. Thanks so much for taking your lunch time to listen to us. We know that you sacrificed eating, maybe reading while you were listening, whatever. And I just want to say a special thank you to Cigna and the partnership at Drug Free for putting together and sponsoring this series. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Sarah, if it's okay, it's Marisa. I wanted to just add a couple of other resources that I was thinking of. There are a number of other kinds of, you know, family-developed, family-organized resources that you can find online. I think the partnership, you could probably connect with them at the partnership, but a number of the parents who are part of the Parent Advisory Board have their own kinds of support organizations. Ours is among them. My husband and I were part of co-founding something called the 24 Group that was mentioned before, and our website is just www.the24group, so it's the numbers 24group.org. And we just have some things on there because those of us that founded it were all families with that shared experience of having a teen who's an addict. So we put things on there that we felt like we discovered were helpful to us and that helped us through this process. But there's Moms Tell, there's I'm not going to remember all the organizations, but there are others that are connected through the partnership that I think families could find additional helpful resources as well.
Great. Thank you for adding that. I appreciate that. Anne, are you there?
Yep. Yeah. So this time we'll pause for our brief five-question survey, and then we'll leave time at the end for some question and answer.
Okay.
Thank you. To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Please tell us to the degree of which you agree or disagree with the following statements by pressing the star key followed by the digit that best corresponds with your answer. The first question, or the first polling question, this session provided me with information on how to address and get the help I need for my loved one. Press star 1 if you strongly agree. Press star 2 to agree. Press star 3 to disagree. And star 4 to strongly disagree. And we'll pause for just a moment. And we'll move on to our next survey question. The session educated me on important things I need to know in regards to getting help from my loved one. Press star 1 to strongly agree, star 2 to agree, star 3 to disagree, and star 4 to strongly disagree. And we'll pause for just a moment. And we'll move on to our next one. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Star 1 to strongly agree. Star 2 to agree. Star 3 to disagree. And star 4 to strongly disagree. And we'll pause for just a moment. And we'll move on to our next survey question. I would recommend this program to others. Press star 1 to agree, or star 2 if you do not agree. And we'll pause for just a moment. And our final survey question, please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with substance abuse issues. Star 1, I am the parent of a child with substance abuse issues. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with substance abuse issues. Or star 3, for other. And we'll pause for just a moment. Thank you for your feedback and for participating in our program. If you would like to make any additional comments to help us improve this program or have any questions on today's topic, press star 1 at this time. When prompted, please record your first name. Your name will be played into the conference indicating your line is open. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, star 1 to ask your question, and we'll pause for just a moment to assemble the queue. And we'll take our first question.
Tom, can you tell the parents who are interested in connecting with Families Anonymous or Al-Anon a good way to find a meeting near them?
Sarah, do you want to do that? I believe you would be able to go on to their website and search for a meeting. I know you can do that through AA.org. You can find AA meetings through that way. I'm not sure if it's the same way through Families Anonymous. If they have their own website, I would think that they do. I could do a quick check.
Yeah, I'm not sure about Families Anonymous. I know to find an Al-Anon meeting, you can go on the website. And you know, I've not been on it recently. I do know that sometimes that information isn't always the most up-to-date, but you can go on the website and find out about meetings. I know you can actually do some online meetings through Al-Anon, and then you can also find out and, like, get a, you know, maybe even just get a number for most of the larger areas have, like, an information center or an information number for that locale, and then that's where you can get probably the most up-to-date information about where the meetings are in your area.
Yes, thank you, Tom. It is familiesanonymous.org, and there is right on their website, or right when you Google that, you're going to see a meeting locator. So you click on meeting locator and find one in your area. And from what I understand, there are a few in the Northeast area, but they're very prevalent in the West and Midwest. There's many, many Families Anonymous meetings out there to support and help. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And once again, to ask your question, please press star followed by the digit 1, and we'll pause for just a moment. And there are no further questions. I will turn the call back over to the speakers for any additional or closing remarks.
No, again, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you as well. It's been great to be able to share this. And I did just go online, and Al-Anon is on the website. It's www.al-anon.alateen, alateen.org. So I might mention that for families that that are affected, if they're siblings, that's another great support for those siblings. And so you can just go on that, and it has right on the homepage, how can I find a meeting.
Thank you. And that will conclude today's call. We thank you for your participation.